General Motors on Safari. Here is adventure. Excitement. And danger. Bringing you the African bushvelts of today and yesterday in dramatized fact, fiction, and true life documentary. General Motors on Safari.
In the winter of 1899, Captain Dunn, a British officer stationed in Egypt, took a small native craft and went on a shooting and fishing expedition along the Sobek River in the Lower Sudan. He stopped to camp one night on the shore. South of him lay thousands of miles of jungle, swamps and deserts, unmapped and unexplored. Dunn's astonishment may well be imagined when, the next morning, he saw coming out of this wilderness a small group of porters, clearly at their last gasp, led by a young Englishman with an unlit pipe in his mouth and a sporting rifle slung over his shoulder. The porters collapsed. The Englishman removed his pipe and bowed politely. Their conversation has been recorded. It was terribly British. Dunn spoke first.
How do you do? Oh, very fit, thanks. How are you? Had any sport?
Pretty fair. Have a drink. You must be hungry, too. Have you had any shooting?
Oh, they're here now.
Excuse me, but would you mind telling me where the devil you've come from?
From the Cape.
The Cape of Good Hope lay 4,000 miles to the south. The Englishman was Colonel Ewart Grogan, and he had walked from the Cape to Cairo. Young Ewart decided to become an artist. He attended one of the best art schools in the country. One day, his bearded teacher held up a sketch the young man was working on and said impressively,
"If you work for many years, living, dreaming, thinking, nothing but art, 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 then you may someday be a great artist."
He waited for Grogan to faint with joy.
"But I'm not sure that I want to be an artist. I think I'd rather become a policeman."
"Then I suggest that you make up your mind."
"Right you are. Heads, I become an artist. Tails, I become a policeman. Sorry, it's tails."
And getting his hat and coat, Grogan left the studio, never to return. Grogan did become a policeman, but it was a policeman of a somewhat special sort. He enlisted as a trooper during the Matabele uprising. After the war, he returned to England, so wasted by fever that the doctors thought he might never completely recover. During his service in South Africa, he'd met Cecil Rhodes and caught that remarkable man's dream of a British Africa extending from Cape Town to the shores of the Mediterranean. It was Grogan's ambition to make the long trek from the Cape to Cairo and map a possible route for the railway. His doctors, however, advised a long rest first. He went to New Zealand and fell in love with a lady by the name of Gertrude Watt. They planned to marry, but Miss Watt had a guardian who did not approve of Ewart.
"Young man, you appear to be drifting down the river of life without a rudder. A girl in the position of my ward can expect to marry an outstanding man."
If I were to walk from the Cape to Cairo, would you consider me sufficiently outstanding?"
"I can only suppose that you're either a fool or have decided to play one. The jungles of Central Africa are impassable. Stanley himself was able to get about only on rivers, and he had to take an armed guard of 600 men to fight off the native tribes. To traverse the continent, you would require a small army."
"Oh, hardly that. If you have a large group, you arouse suspicions. I believe a small party could get through without too much trouble."
This, then, was the start of the famous walk. In February 1898, Ewart S. Grogan and another young Victorian called Arthur Henry Sharp arrived in South Africa and began their memorable trip. For equipment, they had a battery which consisted principally of two sporting magazine 303 rifles, not exactly formidable weapons. The beginning of the trip across the great open plains of the veld proved reasonably easy. Yet it was here that they first encountered African big game. One afternoon, while fishing, they were attacked by a buffalo. Grogan took the shortest cut out of the animal's way. Crocodiles he didn't even consider. Sharp stood his ground. As he was using soft-nosed 303s, the odds were 100-1 on the buffalo, but one of his shots broke the bull's jaw. The animal staggered, and Sharp fired again. The bull fell and rode to within 3 yards of the young man, who promptly finished him off.
You know, I had no idea these animals could take such punishment. The next time one charges me, I'll follow your example and get out of the way.
Ujiji, Lake Tanganyika.
Do you realize, Arthur, this is where Stanley found Livingstone 30 years ago?
Yes, old boy, I do. Stanley took it a lot easier than us, though, I'm thinking.
There are still a lot of Arabs in this town who remember Tipu Tib, the old slaver.
Slavery has been abolished.
Yes, I know, but they're still being cared for by old, old slaves who refuse to leave them.
The Arabs say the mountains ahead are impassable.
So did Gertrude's guardian. We'll get over him.
We've got 130 of the locals who say they'll come. 10 of our own Watonga should be able to keep him in trim, hmm?
No game in the mountains. All food will have to be carried. Be rough,
won't it, up there?
Rough? An understatement. The ridges were 7,000 feet.
Hewitt! The Watonga have deserted!
What a blasted nuisance. I shall keep my journal whatever happens. The weather grows constantly worse. Every morning dawns with the mountains covered by a cold, dank mist. Sharp can scarcely use his hands, so badly have the mosquitoes bitten them. There should not be any mosquitoes up here, but of course, knowing we were coming, every mosquito in the world decided to come and have a bun fight. I have just recovered from a temperature of 106.9. Arthur has blackwater fever. Our men have deserted. Once we reach the valley, the range of mountains beyond are even higher than these. We both feel absolutely dreadful. But apart from this, everything is quite excellent.
Sharp and Grogan reached the valley and stayed at a small village for several weeks, whilst their porters returned to Ujiji, leaving them with 4 Watonga who had come back to them.
Why I should write when I'm quite convinced I'm dying, I do not know. However, our expedition is only just starting, and here we are, expiring. Sea of mountains ahead. Some of the most magnificent scenery in all Africa. Somewhere beyond the ridges lays the great Kivu Lake and the volcanoes. Whether it is possible to reach Kivu from the south, I suppose we shall still have to wait and see. And now I shall stop writing and prepare myself for death. How awfully annoying. Awfully glad you didn't die, Arthur.
I feel much better. Well, it all looks prosperous enough here. Imagine how shocked they'd be at home at the sight of the women here, wearing nothing above their, well, over their...
Oh, yes, I agree. Fields of peas, bananas.
You sound as if you'd rather stay here.
Oh, there are some worse fates.
There are worse.
Some of those children hardly reach up to the beasts' bellies.
I must say, I consider us very lucky to have had so kind a host as King and Genzi. They must have accompanied us for miles.
Well, we'll check stores and get on, I think.
They did check stores and discovered very quickly why Ngenzi, king of the province of Kivu, had been so courteous.
Most of the clothing's gone.
That, Ewart, is a minor matter. The tin box has gone too. Sextants, thermometers, records, photographs.
Artificial horizon.
In fact, the last bally months have been for bally nothing.
All right. Let's go and see Mr. Ngenzi.
Things that have been stolen are of great importance to us. They are of no use to the people of this place. Only to us.
There are many bad men in this country. I cannot keep track of them.
Arthur?
Right. Ow! Always,
my friend, you feel at this moment my colleague's hand. You look at our rifles. Beware of the former and beware even more of the guns.
Genzi! Our belongings! Immediately!
The clothes turned up, but not the valuable instruments. So Grogan and Sharp simply stole from the natives their most valuable possessions. Their cattle. The alarm drum sounded, and hundreds of armed warriors assembled in the hills.
We will return your cattle as soon as our box is given back to us.
The next morning, the tribesmen came. And Genzi spoke.
We have returned your clothes. The other things are worthless. You cannot wear them. You cannot eat them. You cannot cook your food with them. So we have thrown them down a crevice in the hills. They are gone forever. If you shoot your gun at me, if you kill me and take all our cattle, you can never have your belongings back again. Now, please go away from this place and leave us. Go!
The land of the great volcanoes, the other side of Lake Kivu.
Remember how the Watonga wouldn't believe me when I told them about the smoke that pours from the great mountains? Listen. Kalanda! Come here.
Bwana.
Look. See the smoke? Over there? What do you think now?
We still think you are a great liar, Bwana.
Well, there are the burning mountains in front of you.
Bwana, there is no such thing as a burning mountain. You put those there by magic to cheat us.
Many of the cone-like peaks have never before this time been seen by a white man. We have mapped the district and named several of the mountains. The most beautiful I have called Mount Watt. But after all, Gertrude really launched the whole expedition. In spite of illness, the safari is pushing on, making fairly good time.
Mushali, between Lake Kivu and Lake Albert Edward.
Between us and Mushali, there are several miles of old lava beds. The stone sharp. It's a serious barrier to the porter's bare feet.
They can make it. What's more alarming is that there are cannibals over there, swept down through the country from the Congo.
I have no desire to walk into the middle of a native war, Ozan.
Find another way, then.
On their first attempt, their guide deserted them in a forest of impenetrable bamboo. They were miles from water and had a bad time making their way back to camp. They made another attempt with a second guide, and he too deserted them. Grogan lost his temper.
I don't believe there are any cannibals here. And if there are, I no longer care. I'm sick of listening to lies and deceits.
They say there's no water there and that we'll all die of thirst. There are lions too, and all the porters say they're sick. They say they're too weak to walk.
I'm afraid they've made themselves so unpopular with the locals that they won't dare be left behind. They can make themselves sandals for the trip across the lava. And they had better collect water skins now.
They took a herd of goats with them.
Like crossing the Aiguille de Blue Glacier in Europe. Blocks of stone instead of ice.
By late afternoon, they'd crossed the beds of lava and reached the fertile country on the other side. They camped that night by a little pool of clear water, delighted at so easily having surmounted the barrier. The next morning, they found people. People who crept from holes. Wretched people. People who were like the last people living in the world. People who crept from holes. Holes in the lava rocks like wild animals. People who were afraid of the Bareka.
Bareka! At night we steal down to our grain fields and try to take a few armfuls of unripened grain. But the Bareka are watching the fields, and each time they catch some of us.
Bareka are cannibals, huh? Sharp, cannibalism's a myth. Don't subscribe to it. These people are the victims of one of the innumerable tribal wars which massacre district after district. But cannibalism, I don't give a light for.
Grogan left Sharp and started out alone. Sharp agreed to follow later with the heavy equipment. Grogan left the victims of the Bareka and pushed on. He passed through some of the most beautiful country of the entire journey.
On the horizon, a line of great volcanoes stand out against the sky like a Japanese painting. The emerald green of the banana plantations contrast with the gold of the ripening grain fields. And in the distance lay vast rolls of purple hills.
As they neared the first of the grain fields, Grogan could scarcely believe his eyes.
So cannibalism isn't a myth. Such does exist.
The grass was trampled. There was torn clothing and white bones and black ash. It was like walking through a huge abattoir set in the Garden of Eden. And then Grogan and his little party topped a small rise. Instantly, the party was seen by a group of Bareka who were camped in one of the captured villages. The Bareka leapt to their feet, grabbing up their spears and their shields, and charged Grogan's party, howling like wolves.
What are they saying?
They are saying, Bwana, they're going to catch us and eat us.
Indeed.
The leader dropped. The Bareka knew about firearms, and they expected to lose one man. But the firearms they'd encountered hitherto were the muzzle-loading muskets of the Arab traders. The Bareka grew less confident, and some of them ran, and forgot the man with the light sporting rifle, the man who chewed continuously at the stem of an unlit pipe. At last, the Bareka ran for cover, terrified by this new, strange weapon that never ran out of ammunition. The Bareka fled the village. No record exists of what Grogan found in the village. Presumably he could not bring himself to record the slaughter, the devastation, even in the journal. Against the date of his entry into the once occupied village, after the rout of the cannibals, he wrote just...
Skeletons. Skeletons everywhere.
Is it possible that men could do this to other men?
Grogan's party finally managed to win clear of the cannibal area and camped for several days until Sharp, who had come by a different route, managed to catch up. Reunited, the two young men worked their way into Uganda. Here they separated. Sharp decided to go east, crossing what is today Kenya, and take ship at Mombasa for England. Grogan continued northwards, following the Nile towards Egypt.
I am now completely alone. And it is hard to imagine how I'll ever struggle through the miles of desert and swamp that lie ahead. I live with fever. I am never free from the weakening effects of dysentery. In one place we recently passed through, the only additional porters I could find were an old dervish prisoner with a broken leg, a small boy, and a criminal lunatic in chains. A peculiar thing has just happened. I've been out trying to shoot some game for the pot. On returning, I find my friend the lunatic has called all the local natives into the camp and has very carefully distributed my equipment amongst them. Now he has deserted. The natives around here are jolly honest chaps, and on my return they have presented everything back to me again. It does the heart a deal of good to find this sort of thing in the midst of wildest Africa. The mosquitoes are so bad here that at night the baris cover themselves with dung, leaving only a small opening for breathing. They sleep as though encased in plaster casts. One of my poor porters, who fell sick recently, was literally killed by the insects as he slept.
The little party struggled on and on to the north. One of the remaining porters lagged behind one day.
Dinkala! Dinkala!
But the man was never seen again.
No sign of game, precious little water. Last of the grain is gone. All the porters are sick. I feel so bad about prodding the poor devils into continuing. But if they don't, well, they will lose their lives. Of that, there is no doubt. I compute that in 4 days, we shall reach the Sobat River. There will be hippo and possibly water birds. But can we last 4 days? I'm afraid I seriously doubt it.
But they did. The little party came out of a small desert and heard the birds, and they heard the sound of water. And ahead of him, Grogan saw a thin stick swaying in the wind. Hardly daring to believe the truth, Grogan realized it was the mast of a small boat.
How do you do? Very fit, thanks. How are you? And in this sport?
Excuse me, but would you mind telling me where the devil you come from?
From the Cape.
From the Sobats, Grogan went on to Cairo by boat. The four Watonga porters who had stayed with him all the way from Nyasaland, the four who had deserted him and then returned, were interested, but not unduly impressed with the wonders of civilization. One day, while one of these porters was out with Grogan, acting as gunbearer, they saw a train speeding across the desert. The gunbearer tapped Grogan on the shoulder, pointed to the oncoming train and said,
"Your elephant gun, Bwana."
Grogan returned to New Zealand, where he and Miss Gertrude Watt were married. They travelled extensively in the States and in Europe, but Ewart couldn't get Africa out of his blood. He travelled to Kenya, then a very new but thriving colony. Here Mrs. Grogan joined him at a place called Nairobi, which was at that time a city of tents. Eventually, Ewart S. Grogan and his lady wife settled at Taveta, not far from the Tanganyika border. In 1963, Michael McCabe of Springbok Radio met the old man at the last New Year's party at the Muthaiga Club just outside Nairobi. The last New Year's party in the old fashion, for Uhuru was about to be proclaimed, and the Kenya that Grogan knew in his youth was passing. At 90 years of age, the old adventurer was still very fit, still upright. There was still the light in his eyes which had endured through the hardships of the walk from Cape to Cairo to win a bride.
Join us again next week for another story of the African Bushveld. It might be fact, it might be fiction, in General Motors on Safari. Brought to you by General Motors South African, manufacturers of Cadillac, Buick, Oldsmobile, Pontiac, Chevrolet, Beaumont, Vauxhall, Opel, Holden, Bedford, and GMC Motor Vehicles.